Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. This is the first time you're tuning in with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. The best way to do that is to follow me on X at Focused Compound. If you have a particular question or topic you would like us to go over exclusively on the podcast, we'll make one whole podcast out of it. You could send that to me at andrew@focusedcompound.com. If you're going to be in Omaha this year at the Berkshire meeting and would like to meet up, reach out to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. So in today's podcast, Jeff, we're going to be talking about things that look cheap to you currently, industries that look cheap to you. You had wanted me to pull up EBITDA multiples by industry this year. This is as of, my birthday, February 29th, 2024. And the thing that stood out to you, you were saying, everything that is under 10 times is, you know, sort of like insurance, banks, but then like airlines, supermarkets, really tangible things. So wanted to talk to you about that, home building, see what your thoughts are on that. Are these more things that are tied to the market cycle and the economy? What's going on here? And just see where, you know, you're currently looking, where things are looking cheap to you.
Yeah. So this was, I got an email from someone. And I knew the person, so talking to them, I knew that there would be some ESG concerns, right? So in terms of some things that I might suggest, I would say, well, I could suggest that, because I might know more about some U.S. stocks and things, and so I'd be like, what industries are cheap? I'd say, well, I'd suggest this, except it has this kind of bias to it. And the bias that I was noticing is, yes, ESG, it might be a possible explanation, but other possible explanations is old economy versus new, which was a much bigger distinction in the tech boom of the 90s than in later ones. And that also could be showing itself the same way now, because I remember that split between those two things back then in terms of what was value priced and what wasn't. And then the other thing is that some of them are cyclical, but that may not be as big a factor, because cyclical things that didn't seem tangible, or old economy, that wasn't helping to explain it. And then the last one is inflation, right? Because the old economy things, those things also could be things that are more affected by inflation. So maybe people believe that these multiples on them are actually not low, because the future, that they're more highly cyclical and they might be over earning at this point. But that also had problems explaining it. So the best explanation was really the that I could come to was the old versus new, the tangible offline versus the intangible online. Because any other explanation I could come up with, I would say, okay, well, it could be cyclical. But then I was having problems because that doesn't make sense, because you can see some of these things that are old but non-cyclical. No one believes like office supplies or something is a highly cyclical industry, right? But then, so you could say, okay, that makes perfect sense for coal or for whatever, but then it doesn't make so much sense for some others. And I also tried by doing the same idea, well, let me pick things that are intangible but cyclical. No, they're still expensive. So that wasn't it. So it really, the best explanation as we go through this that I could find, and maybe you find something different, is an old, dirty, physical,
diversified chemicals.
Yeah. Anything that fits that bill, it's stuff that existed in the 1970s versus stuff that's been invented in more recent times and doesn't have much of an offline existence. There's a huge price difference. So we could just go, what are some of the industries here that you see the multiple is low on? And we're, this
yeah,
is
EBITDA and I'll multiples. Just read it across. Yeah. Yeah, and this is as of end of February. Bobber Body, he calls this the revenge of the old economy, which I thought is just perfectly like phrased for basically going forward, you're going to have this flip from old economy type companies to, flip it back to have like the tech stuff revert back. But so yeah, coal at 4 times, construction engineering at 9.4 times. I'm just going to name stuff that's basically below 10 times. Diversified chemicals, diversified industrial goods and wholesalers, 9 times. Diversified mining, 8 times. Electric utilities, 10 times. And then you got a bunch of fishing and farming. So a lot of agricultural stuff, less than 10 as well. Let's see, gold 9 times, freight 10 times, home furnishings 10 times, home building 8 times. Yeah, so lots of stuff. Oil and gas 5 times.
Mm-hmm. But then there were even ones, like we said, with tobacco or office supplies or something, which are clearly non-cyclical. They're super not cyclical, right? These are consumables, and but they could be declining over time, right? So demand for tobacco could be going down at a steady rate, but all the time. And demand for office supplies could be going down over time. Not by a lot, but it could be. So no growth to slightly negative growth. Same thing with the utilities things you mentioned. Like, again, that's not highly cyclical for utilities. I mean, wholesale things and stuff are, but retail things aren't. But it is possible that, there's like no growth in electricity stuff much before COVID. There might be some growth. I haven't looked at things recently. There might be some growth in the United States now with, there's certain things like Bitcoin mining and certain applications of technology things like we're doing, talking about all the AI things and stuff. There could be non-retail sorts of things that are helping for demand for electricity that there didn't used to be. But putting those aside, it would be close to no to down, right? Or at least per capita, it's not growing at all. So that's another industry. So it's things that like people are consuming more of as a society as they go forward seem to be very future oriented, right? Because like, okay, per person in most of these industries, not all, most, we think we're going to use less of it, right? I don't know about home building and stuff, but let's say whatever you argue about coal, you think per person, we're going to use less coal in the future. But per person, maybe we're going to all going to use more Netflix in the future or whatever. You know what I mean? And so if you divide it that way of societal risks of, okay, tobacco down in the future, even I said electricity flat or down or whatever, but not the things that are expensive. That's all I could come up with. Now, they can be ESG things, which is the other theory here, right? Which is, okay, so funds, indexes, things like that. Sometimes there's exposure. I mean, like I was talking to someone, I said, look, like for us, there's an explanation for why some things are cheap, but people might not buy it, because I was suggesting a few things. And I said, actually, the 3 best ones I can come up with in this industry for you, there's a problem. You have to file additional tax things, which may be why they're cheaper, right? None of them are they're publicly traded, but they're not a C corporation. There was another industry where that was true too. So I was like, okay, the very cheapest ones I can tell you that I think are cheaper than what someone would pay to acquire them would be not a C corporation. And that could be for individuals, that's a huge deal, right? For institutions, maybe ESG is a big enough deal that it could actually be affecting the prices. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I would say that's true. Just capital outflows. I mean, how would you explain things like shipbuilding 6 times, right? What does that tell you?
Well, this is where it gets complicated because
the economy is technically hot, right? So
that's what's interesting. So it could be that things are over earning, right? And I thought about that, but there's somewhere I fundamentally disagree on that. So the market could have a different view than I do, but where I see problems with that is, generally versus what they used to trade at and past earnings things and stuff, I think supermarkets and airlines are pretty cheap, right? I don't think they're amazingly cheap, but I think they're quite cheap relative to the market. And they're somewhat strange from the perspective of thinking that they're over-earning. Supermarkets are earning more than they did before, but it's hard to believe that they... What do you have here? Do you have retail food? Does it tell you how does it break down what I was saying about supermarkets?
I'm not seeing from this list.
So it should be food retail. Why don't you go to food? It'll probably be food. Under food and then say retailing and wholesale and stuff. Yeah. So what does it say?
Supermarkets and convenience stores. We have 9 times.
The problem with that is the convenience stores are the expensive one. The supermarkets are cheap. But one comparison is, to me, and again, this is a me personal thing and people could really disagree, but to me, there's an odd split on certain things. Like dollar store is very popular as a stock, or were until recently. Supermarkets not. And it's hard to, and I don't get that as much. They're pretty similar in a lot of ways and they have different models. They're more organic growth of the dollar things. I don't think the dollar things are better competitively in the future and stuff. I just think that maybe there's a few of them that are quite successful, you know. So supermarkets like a Sprouts or something that says it's going to open more stores and whatever could be a pretty high multiple. And so maybe that's also why there could be on a Dollar General or Dollar Tree or whatever at a time when they're opening stores. Now, some of them are saying we're closing stores and stuff. So that changed family, you know. But I think that that's an odd dichotomy to me. And it's surprising throughout too, because even things like Target and Walmart and stuff, which are heavily similar to supermarkets, they sell other things and stuff. But I mean, like their growth rates for the categories they're in are similar. They have to take market share or open new stores or something, just like a supermarket. And yet their pricing as a stock seems higher to me than the same thing. Kroger's not that cheap. So it could be that really big. I mean, the other thing I just think is that maybe there's more smaller supermarkets. There's not enough giant supermarket chains. So Kroger is the biggest pure supermarket publicly traded in the United States. And what's its market cap?
Kroger, we're at $40 billion.
Yeah. And Albertsons is one of the other biggest ones. But then you have Walmart and Target and stuff. So I think possibly it's also that there's some things that might have bigger market, bigger size, could be being rewarded with higher prices. I don't, as stocks, I don't see that in, but what's weird about that is I don't see that with, more technology things. Like the smaller ones don't have, you know, and you just brought up Greenberg Partners. I don't think Greenberg Partners isn't that expensive versus its recent earnings, but it doesn't generally trade at a discount compared to like KB and bigger home builders, or I guess the stock people would know the best, I think, is probably NVR at this point. Like for investors, that would be the one that's most famous to them.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I noticed that with supermarkets and, they all have high earnings recently versus the past, but their margins could come down, but I don't know that their earnings will come down all that much. Because if you look at COVID, that spiked their revenue, but their revenue is not going to come down because prices, inflation will come down. But you know, when they say inflation is transitory, they don't mean prices are transitory. Once the prices go up, they stay up. So
How would you think about like Greenberg Partners, right? So it's currently trading, at least on recent earnings, 8x earnings. This is a company that we've spoken about before in the podcast. Mm-hmm. Mortgage rates are at, you know, 7.1. I think I saw a headline today, 7.1%, and mortgage demand has cratered. I personally am of the view that I think rates are going to be higher. I think the Fed is behind the curve and inflation is much more sticky than they had anticipated, or maybe they did anticipate it, and maybe perhaps they... Maybe they just didn't want to raise interest rates for certain reasons outside of the Fed. I'm not sure. But like expectations of interest rates are starting to change, with the expectation being that rates are going to be higher for longer, right? I think when we came into this year, Jeff, wasn't it 6 rate cuts this year is what was being priced in at one point? And I believe when the talks of interest rates starting to cut started happening a lot more, the market actually took off. So now you're kind of reversing that where we sit here today on the 18th of April. But how do you think about Greenbrick, right? So it does look like It's trading cheap. Do you look at, is that cheap for a home builder? Mortgage rates are higher. The economy is still strong. Just kind of curious. I mean, there's still a shortage of homes in this country. So housing demand hasn't really slow down as much as I think people would have thought, with rates going from, you know, 2 to 7. And that's what's crazy about like these shortages, right? My uncle, he has a mortgage 2.5%. He's like, we're not leaving. We want to leave. We want a bigger house, but we have a 2.5% mortgage. We're not leaving. So it's just kind of interesting to see how that's going to play itself out over the next handful of years.
Yeah. And the United States, you know, people can have fixed rate mortgages and they can keep them. And they can often put on home equity loans and stuff at current rates on top of that, as, you know, junior to that. So they could even tap some without giving up the original loan that they had. So in other words, like you were saying, what it can mean is that people can feel that they're stuck in a particular house because they can't move the mortgage with them, basically. So they're, the only way they can keep an old rate is by keeping the house that they have, even if they would like to move or they would like to borrow. Either one of those things, they're not going to do it. Because the rate is too low on what they have before, right? So the thing with Green Brick, right, is what you were just saying with the inflation. So we looked at it before, and I looked at what's the value versus what the land is and all that. And what it turned out, of course, is that this is what like a DCF or future or any stock analysis you do, right, is basically saying not what it is now, but what's the future going to be. And what was not put into that the model that I was thinking is actually land will be worth 30% or more than I think it will be because there'll be a lot of money printed and stuff basically during COVID that basically the price levels will change and the amount of land and where it is will stay the same. And that's what happened. And if you knew that ahead of time, then you would have come to a very different conclusion and said, I should buy that. But I think you also would have come to the conclusion you should buy the supermarkets and stuff. Because if you knew that price levels of everything on the store shelves were going to go up by a lot over the next few years, then you feel differently. Right before COVID, there was deflation in the supermarket industry, right? And I don't know how bullish people were on housing before COVID happened. If anything, their rates had only been brought up slightly, and then there was worries about that and stuff. And everyone said, well, if rates really go up, it's not going to be good for housing. And I don't think that a lot of people saw house prices as a big thing about the future way to make money and everything. And now they've held up remarkably well with higher rates, like you said. But some of that is thinking in terms of nominal instead of real terms. You know, I've said that where I was shocked when I see what banks, insurers, tax authorities, et cetera, Zillow thinks my house is worth versus what I would think it should be worth. But when I readjust my thinking and say, well, actually, when I factor in how much inflation there's been since buying it, yes, on real terms, it is weaker. It should be weaker, but you're not seeing any decline in nominal pricing because of that, right? Because my thing is, look, I bought into a very hot housing market. It's clearly not. You can see the difference in terms of the supply and demand imbalance in the area. And so you're like, it can't possibly be priced the same way, but it is priced the same way in nominal terms, you know? Half a century ago, home building stuff wasn't as good though, because wages were rising faster than land stuff in a high inflation environment at that time at some points. And that was the worst for them. So one thing that's tricky about this, and the Fed talks about this and everything, is it's not just that inflation can be high or low. It's that as inflation is higher, it is less stable. And so if you really look, when you average it out, you might say, oh, that decade had 5% inflation. But sometimes inflation is at 2% and sometimes it's at 6%. And you're seeing this as the cycle is going in terms of the economy. And it's pretty violent. And so if labor costs accelerate a lot and housing does not do well, it's not good for home builders, right? I mean, home builders are exposed in terms of everything else also can inflate. So they like it a lot when the asset value of homes and stuff is strong, but you're not seeing too much pressure on other things. And that's true for all the things we talk about. That's also when we talk about steel things or whatever, everyone thinks about the output. But at some point with a lot of inflation, you get problems with the inputs, right? And so the results aren't always good because although revenue is higher, you know, the margins are all over the place. It usually leads to huge instability in margins. Actually, we can see that with supermarkets probably. If you put in, well, we can look at home builders too. Let's just do a supermarket because they're normally very, very predictable. Let's do Kroger or any other one. If there was an inflation or deflation, their margins would probably be incredibly similar from year to year, their operating margins, right? But what do we have in the more recent year since COVID? Has that affected the margins at Kroger, the operating margins?
So the operating margins have gone up, but no, it's kind of just been bouncing. I mean, I'll just read across right from 2015 onward, 3%, 3%, 3%. I'll just read onward the I'll add the decimal. 2.9, 3.3, 3, 1.7, 2.1, 1.8, 2.1, 2.5, 2.8, 2.1.
Okay. My memory is Kroger is all LIFO except for fuel, but I could be wrong about that. So I think that Kroger uses LIFO accounting. A lot of supermarkets use LIFO, which allows them, there's a last in first out instead of FIFO, first in first out, or average cost method or something, which is allowed in the United States to reduce your tax bill if you also use it for financial accounting purposes. And the main function of that is to, in a period of inflation, underreport your earnings. It's particularly noticeable in terms of gross numbers to people, but it goes through the entire statement to it leads to a higher quality of earnings, in the sense that you're reporting less and less in earnings versus what you're actually earning. It's only meaningful, and I pointed out because I mentioned this with like a lot of supermarkets and stuff would use something like LIFO, but a lot of like car makers would use FIFO. And if you have like what happened with supply chain slowdowns and all sorts of weird things with that and inflation, it's meaningful because the turns are so poor that you're booking a large amount of profit, which is just from holding something during a period of inflation, right? So like if you had a jewelry store and it's all FIFO, in inflation, you would think that you were earning money when you're not. Because the increase would be so big and the turns are so slow, that you think that you have that you're making 20% or something and you're making zero. Because the question is, when you sell a diamond and turn around and try to buy another diamond, are you paying less for the diamond you're buying than you paid to sell a diamond? If not, your gross profit is actually zero. And that's just, I don't remember if Kroger does, but a lot of things that sell stuff like that in the United States do use LIFO.
Mm-hmm. So out of the industries that you think are cheap, possible industries, airlines, supermarkets, home building, insurance, and banks, is there one in particular that you've been spending more time on that you think are worthy of other people taking a look at?
Well, I mean, I think the two that are most interesting are probably supermarkets and airlines. For us, I think that supermarkets are the most interesting to look at because of size. There's more small supermarkets in the United States that are publicly traded. Airlines, I think that there's not a lot of great airlines in the United States except for the biggest airlines, the biggest passenger airlines. So Southwest and then the legacy airlines, basically, which carry most of the passengers. You do have, like we obviously talked about, Spirit, JetBlue, and there's some other ones that are publicly traded, but their business models are a little more specific. So yeah, let's look at Southwest, for instance. Southwest is the simplest to look at because it doesn't have a big, whatever they want to call it. What do they call it? Loyalty in for most of the others when they break out information about it, when they're talking about, Southwest is the most focused on domestic passengers in the United States, so not exposed as much to international stuff, and more purely an airline in the sense that it doesn't have anything with your credit card miles, your airline miles and stuff, and partnerships and all of that stuff that the others have that's become big for them. Southwest is very minimal in terms of offering you any sort of benefits to be a frequent flyer.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you look at, let's look at operating profit. Okay, so you're talking pre-COVID, you know, some $3 billion in operating profit.
Mm-hmm.
And then since COVID, it's, you know, 2020 was negative 3.8, 2021, 1.7, 2022, a billion, 2023, $224 million. So what has happened to Southwest Airlines post-COVID?
So all the airlines' earnings are bad. They're quite bad.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few things. One, we have higher input costs for airlines as compared to other industries, right? We've seen that in the news. So you have fuel costs higher, right? You have labor costs higher as compared to other industries, which haven't had the same amount of just a round of union stuff that then adjusts everything up, right? And then you also had you had bailouts of that stuff. But demand is back in it the way that it is for, you know, airlines are basically one of these COVID things that was affected the same as movie theaters and cruises in the United States. And they're all affected differently. A lot of them were wiped, had a lot of their equity diluted. in some cases. Even things where we talk about markets or something, they have a convertible and they have different ways to protect themselves against the full effect of that. But that does mean that they are diluting their equity. And then with the cruise lines, they just have an obscene amount of debt compared to what they used to have for some of them. So with the airlines, the question is whether it can get back to levels versus revenue that are profitable. And what's interesting there is that many airlines have as much revenue as they've ever had, basically, and are predicting even higher going forward. So what I find interesting about that is the expectation has to be that there's like no margin, right? So
yeah, that's what's being priced in basically, right?
Yeah. So like if we just take this, for instance, let's see. So Southwest, let's use pre-tax income, I think is what, 11.5% over the last 10 years. That's a median number, so it doesn't punish them for very low recent numbers. But obviously it was higher in all years pre-COVID, right? So it's a safe number to use because basically that number was that high or higher. Yeah. Well, since COVID, yes. It was all over the place before. There's not much of a pattern before COVID. And then after COVID, it just falls off a cliff. But if we use something like that, right, and then you tax it, okay, you're still at a margin that would be what? That it has to be 8% or higher, I would say. You know, it's hard to come up with any number that would expect that their pre-tax margin should be less than 8%. And yet we know that, what do we say? Their most recent one is, let's use $25 billion, right? So if you were expecting 8% on that, then obviously you're expecting, what, about $2 billion? In operating profit is probably what you'd expect. And they were at 2 billion to three or higher, four actually, every year pre-COVID. So it's hard to imagine it. Do you think that going forward, they could on average make less than $2 billion a year?
Yeah, I don't know. If not, if if that's not true, if they can make more than that, then it's probably a good buy, right? What does the stock chart look like? The whole industry has just gone smoked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're back to, 2015 levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where Buffett was buying these stocks, right? 2015, mm-hmm. He was probably buying them. So it's fascinating to me that way. I don't know. One way to do it is to just say, okay, look, revenue. Do you think that people expect airline prices and number of passengers carried to decline in the future?
I would say no.
Okay. So then it's just a margin question. We can say no.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Southwest isn't that complicated too. I pick it because, like I said, it's simple, but also from credit perspective and stuff, it should be the easiest because it owns more of its own things. It does have to take, it's not going to happen, but it was going to take a lot of possession of Boeing things to redo their fleet and stuff. And that's not going to happen at the pace it was before. If you put that out, their commitments to do that, it's very safe credit wise. So it's the least levered and most owning its own stuff and not exposed to a lot of leases and a lot of debt that comes due and stuff. So it makes it very simple that you'd say, okay, it's just United States, it's just passengers carried in the ticket prices, and then I have to apply some sort of margin to that. So how low was would the margin have to go to make it cheap? So what does it say is the market cap in EV right now?
Market cap is $17 billion, enterprise value $13 billion.
Okay. And then I think, let's see, so if we do let's see. Okay, so a stock would be cheap probably in the United States with current tax rates, or be fairly valued or not bad if it was 12 times EBIT or less, probably. Because we'd say tax rates are in the right now, and we talked about maybe they could change in the future. But if we're talking 25% or whatever, then it's about 12 times. So we can just say, let's look at market cap. What we have in terms of market cap is we've got, because EV is not, it's not important with Southwest. So what's the market cap?
$17 billion.
Okay. Right. So I guess we could say if you think they'll earn less than $1.5 billion in EBIT, right? I think that then it would be, you could justify being called expensive today, right? So if we do 1.5 on, what did we say? We have $26 billion or something right now in revenue?
In revenue, mm-hmm.
So a little less than 6%. So you think margins are now going to average 6%, and in the past they averaged 12? What do we have the EBIT average? Yeah. But that 12 includes COVID. What was the average? I mean, read across what the average years were for us in operating margin pre-COVID. So 2014 to,
2014 onward, 12.6, 21, 17.4, 16.1, 14.6, 13.2. 2020 was negative 42, 2021, 10.9, 2022, 4.3, 2023 was 0.9.
Yeah, so I just, we haven't talked about the different reasons why it might be that people think airlines won't do well for a while. The questions are, what can we come up with are reasons that they permanently won't do that well? But two, what we're trying to lay out here, and this is what I was trying to lay out with supermarkets the same way, is remember, like say with supermarkets, and airlines I think both fit this, certainly Southwest does, they have a lot of stuff of a network that they put stuff through, right? So like there's a certain level of, we say, passengers and ticket prices with an airline that we're pretty sure of what those will be. We don't know how much profit they'll be on them, but we know what they'll be. And I think that's very true for supermarkets. They got a certain number of stores. The physical volume, if we could somehow measure that, it's not going to change a lot. We know how much physical stuff is going to come in and out of the store all the time. So the question is, how much is the margin going to change? And what I think with supermarkets, which is the same with airlines here, is for some of them, you have to start plugging in numbers that are below any numbers we saw before COVID. Because yes, their margin is odd now, but like let's look at, let's see. One that wasn't acquiring, Engels you could use, or we talked about Village before. You can use Engels, I-N-G-L-E-S, because that's different than Village, which is the one I mentioned the most. The thing that I think is important is the revenue growth since COVID. So start with 2020 and give me revenue growth numbers, because this is what I want to stress.
2020 was 9.7, 2021 8.2, 2022 was 13.9, and 2023 was 3.8.
So that's revenue. In my book, that's not, that I don't believe is going to reverse. I just don't see that on average, nominal revenue at supermarkets is going to be lower in the future than it is now. Airlines, depending on airline pricing, and there's some cyclicality, can be. I think if you go over a period of years, it will not be. I think, you know, that it's hard to come up with numbers that say that the market will actually shrink. But in both cases, my point is, so we can do margin, because this is the part that can change. I agree that margin can shift. So what's margin been in 2020 through today?
Do you want gross or operating?
Just operating margin, yeah.
Okay, operating margin 2020, 6.0, 2021, 6.8, 2022, 6.6, 2023, 4.9.
Right. And the long-term average was what on the EBIT? It's much lower.
3.6.
Right.
Was a 10-year median margin.
Right. So what people are saying is, okay, you could have the margin cut in half or something, is what I think people might be saying that's reasonable, that it can go back to pre-COVID levels. And I think that that is possible. Sure. Now, because of the way these things work, I do want to point out there's an automatic plus or minus to inflation a little bit, depending on your turns, captured by the fact of inflation. So inflation actually has to stabilize, is at like a zero or something, not level off. Because if inflation levels off at a higher level, then basically you earn more because prices are rising while you own things. But generally, we could just say that absent that, if you really think inflation will go back to levels it was before COVID, that's the good assumption. Inflation won't just stop, not increase anymore. It'll stay here, but actually it'll drop back to where it was and then stay flat with COVID. If we did that, then you could say, okay, margins will be the same in the future. If it stabilizes at a higher inflation rate, actually margins won't be the same. But if it stabilizes at the old inflation rate, then margins can go back to where they were before. But I don't think revenue will go back to the way it was before. And that's what I'm stressing. So I just think it's interesting in trying to do this application to airlines and supermarkets. One way to think about it is, well, how far would their margins have to go down compared to what they were before? With the things like home builders and stuff, I guess you can justify. You can certainly justify in shipbuilding or any of those things, right? We could come up with any number. Steel, you can tell me any number for revenue, and I might believe you. You could say they'll sell less than they used to in terms of tons of things. You could tell me the price will be wildly different, right? But I'm trying to pick things that I think airlines and supermarkets, it's hard for people to imagine a huge collapse in transactions in the future, right? And the number of transactions. Or I think even with airline tickets, I don't think people expect the long-term average future price nominally to be lower. I don't think people are expecting that it'll be cheaper to fly than ever was before. So if both of those things are true, it all has to come from pressure in the margin to explain the over-earning, because revenue won't go back down to pre-COVID. And even if you apply that to things, it's hard. The Kroger and stuff it works for, but both with airlines and supermarkets, the ones we looked at, even if I apply the full reduction in margin stuff, I'm not getting anything priced above 15 times earnings or something. And a lot of the most all the market is over 15 times earnings. So I just find that interesting that you're expecting something to decline by that much. That it would all be pressure to margin. Yeah. Same thing. When I look at Village or something, to go back to pre-COVID levels on margin, but revenue stays the same, might get you to 12 or 13 times earnings, maybe.
Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focused Compounding Podcast. If you would like to send in a question, have it read aloud, and we could discuss on the podcast, you could email it to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. Just put podcast question in the subject line. If you're going to be in Omaha and would like to meet up with Jeff, feel free to reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com so we can set that up. I thank everybody so much for all the support. Be sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening or watching us, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.